We're drawing near, I suspect we still have a few more weeks to go, but we're, when I began this class, I didn't know, you know, how far I wanted to go and all that, and I know I want to deal with sexual crimes and just penalties for them. There's a lot of controversy surrounding those issues. And today's topic is going to kind of transition to that issue by talking particularly about divorce. And some of the things that I'm going to share today, I've shared in the past in a kind of a piecemeal sort of way, and have mentioned a few times in this study, but I wanted to put it all together because I think this is an important topic that really can show us not only the beauty of God's law, but ways that it might be applied effectively today to deal with a very, very serious problem in the church today. And what I mean by that is we live in a time in which, you know, half of all marriages end in divorce. And there's a lot of confusion in the literature over what the Christian response ought to be to divorce. In times past, and what you'll find in our Westminster Confession of Faith, even though it hints there might be more, what you'll find is that the traditional view held by many within evangelical reform circles is that the only grounds for divorce is adultery. And that's based on Jesus' words in Matthew 5, where he says, Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you, whoever divorces his wife for any reason except, my Bible says, sexual immorality. But the old King James says, except adultery, causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. So based on that, traditionally, many Christians have believed that adultery is the only basis for divorce. And people who have been divorced for other reasons are oftentimes, historically, I think, been treated sometimes like second-class citizens in the church. They've been denied positions of leadership, and it's as if sometimes they've committed the unpardonable sin. I think it's very important to point out that God himself suffered a divorce. We see that in Jeremiah 3:8. God says, then I saw that for all the causes for which backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a certificate of divorce. Now, God obviously, we might say that in some cases, well, a person was driven to something or tempted to something because of the actions of their spouse. Clearly, that was not the case with God. You know, Israel was sinful. He was a completely innocent party in the matter. So, you know, for many, this traditional view is divorce is the adultery is the only grounds for divorce. Some people will allow willful desertion historically, based on comments Paul makes in 1 Corinthians 7. It says, you know, if you're living with an unbelieving spouse and they want to leave, well, then, you know, let them leave. Don't you leave, but if they want to, you know, you can let them. And so some people will say, well, that's possible you might remarry. Only thing is, Paul just says, let them leave. He doesn't really give instruction about whether they can remarry. And so not everyone has always allowed for remarriage in that case. Now, what happens is then this matter of willful desertion becomes a topic of conversation. A number of years ago, the PCA did a position paper on divorce because this affects so many people because it affects, you know, half of all marriages. They did a study into the scriptures about what it says in regard to divorce and said, you know, that willful desertion could be extended to mean more than simply leaving the premises. Okay, it could be more than somebody simply abandoning the marriage. They included things like physical abuse, drunkenness, lack of financial support, denial of conjugal rights, etc. All of those things, the position paper basically says in effect, willful desertion. So the person may still be living in the house, but for all practical purposes, they have denied their marriage vows, and for those reasons, they might be lawfully divorced. Okay? So on the one hand, traditionally, there's been a real narrow basis for divorce. In more modern times, the pendulum has kind of gone to the other side, where it's kind of like, it just anything goes kind of position, where, it's just the reality we deal with, and it's not addressed, adequately in the church. What I'm going to try to argue today is, that the Bible, by implication, broadens the grounds for divorce beyond adultery, because that's not what Jesus said. But it does give us some actual objective standards by which we can make those decisions. Okay? And you have to follow along with me a little bit, try to follow the flow of the argument. We're going to connect some dots. But I hope I can make a convincing case to you that is, maybe you would call it something of a mediating position between some of the extremes that have surrounded this topic. Okay? Let me explain. First of all, in regard to Jesus' comments about adultery, okay? Like I said, in Matthew 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, "But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery." Okay? That's how my Bible translates that. The old King James said adultery. You need to point out that Jesus is in the Sermon on the Mount, like other places when he speaks on divorce and remarriage, is seldom trying to give a complete treatise on the topic. Usually what he is doing is he is addressing a particular question posed to him or a particular problem. We know in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is taking issue with the teachings of the scribes and Pharisees. At the beginning, he says, "Don't think that I've come to destroy the law and the prophets. I didn't come to destroy them. I came to fulfill the law. And whoever breaks the least of his commandments is going to be least in the kingdom of heaven." Jesus is going to say some things he knows can be misconstrued. So he wants to make it clear at the outset he's not doing away with the law. And then curiously, he mentions the scribes and Pharisees in verse 20. He says, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." Okay, why bring them in? Well, they're the principal teachers of the law in that time. So Jesus is going to say some things that's going to go against what they have taught. Some people might misconstrue that to say Jesus is doing away with the law, but he's made it clear he's not. And so, throughout the Sermon on the Mount, he introduces his topics by saying, "You have heard it has been said, and he says, "But I say unto you." He never says, "Moses said, but I say unto you." He doesn't say, "It is written, but I say unto you." He says, "You have heard it said of those of old." Again and again. This is what you've been taught, in other words. This is the tradition of the scribes and Pharisees. Remember, Jesus got on them about how they nullify God's commandments by their traditions. And so he introduces each topic that way. "You've heard it said. It has been said." Again, "You've heard that it was said to those of old." Over and over again. And so when we get to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, people recognize a clear contrast between Jesus' teaching and the teachings of the scribes and Pharisees. Then to chapter 7 in Matthew, it says, "So it was when Jesus had ended these things that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes." Okay? They saw a clear contrast between the teachings of the scribes and Pharisees and the teachings of Jesus. Now, with that in mind, it's important to note, we know from the first century, from sources like Josephus and others, that the Pharisees taught that a man could divorce his wife for just all sorts of reasons, including burning the biscuits, talking too loudly, not seasoning the soup just right. That might be pretty serious, you know. They found ways to divorce their wives for virtually anything at all. What Jesus does in response throughout is reiterate the actual teaching of the Old Testament. Turn over to the second page now. And so he says, you know, whoever divorces wife, let him, but I say to you, whoever divorces wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery. Need to point out that you'll find in most all modern translations, that's how it will be put. It won't be said as adultery. And the reason is that the word moikao, which is the word for adultery, is not what is used there. Okay? The word that Jesus uses is porneia, from which we get pornography. And it basically means indecent thing. And what I'm suggesting to you is, by using the word porneia rather than moikao, Jesus is broadening the grounds for divorce. Now, he's not advocating what the scribes and Pharisees are teaching to simply, you know, kind of any cause at all, but he does broaden it beyond adultery. Okay? The reason I say that is this. About 200 years before Christ's ministry, the Jews translated the Old Testament scriptures, which were written in Hebrew, into Greek. And that translation is known as the Septuagint. When the Babylonians conquered Israel and carried them off into captivity, the children growing up in that culture naturally began speaking the language of Babylon, which was Aramaic. So that by the time they come back from captivity, Hebrew had basically become a dead language. It was the scholar's language. It was like Latin. You know, people who go to the academy speak Latin, but the most common people can't. Well, the Jews who lived in Palestine then, they all spoke Aramaic. So Hebrew was dying off. And because of the Hellenization and the Greek conquest of everything, pretty much everyone spoke Greek as the universal language. Like in India today, you have all these different dialects, but when they meet in assembly, they all speak English. That's how they, you know, they communicate together. I think Switzerland has, what, 3 official languages too, and I don't remember which one they speak in when they all in together or whatever. So what the Jews did is they translated the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures into Greek, into what became known as the Septuagint. What you find in the New Testament is when the apostles quote the Old Testament, usually they're quoting the Septuagint. So if sometimes you see a quote in the New Testament and you go back to the Old Testament and it's not quite the same, well, that's because when you go from one language to the next, you know, you're always, you know, you have to do a little, work to make sense of it in the next language, okay? Now, Paul was a scholar. Paul spoke Hebrew. And Paul preferred the Hebrew text, but the apostles in general sometimes Paul will quote the Septuagint, and scholars are like, why did he quote the Septuagint there, you know? But they will quote the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Now, the reason I bring that up is, that word porneia that Jesus uses there is used in regard to a lot of things in the Septuagint. And things such as rape, bestiality, whoredom, incest, homosexuality, and a host of other things. Now you can easily see rape, bestiality, incest, homosexuality, all those things being different forms of sexual immorality, right? Well, the porneia is usually associated with illicit sexual practices, but it also was used for just general abhorrent behavior in a more general sense, okay? Including things like provoking the Lord to anger by distrust, an arrogant way of life, things like rebellion, witchcraft, idolatry, etc. Okay? So porneia could include many different things. Now, years ago, Greg Bonson did you got a question? Yeah.
Are you saying that those things, those examples in particular, rebellion, witchcraft, and idolatry, those are the word porneia was used in a lot of particular cases?
Yes.
Okay. And I guess it kind of makes sense because, Israel poured themselves out with the local God, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It would be in that way. Let me say, so often ancient religions entailed sexual practices. That was the big lure for so many. You know, Baal was the storm god. He was the male storm god, and Asherah was, like the female storm god. And for agricultural people, people in the ancient world generally thought each land had their particular god. And so when Israel is coming into the land, God warns them about worshiping Baal. Now, if you're an Israelite and your crops aren't doing well, you want Baal to cause it to rain. That's why Elijah set up the test that he did on Mount Carmel. Now, what you would do, basically, a lot of these worship services would entail sexual intercourse as a way, basically, to turn the gods on so that they would make it rain, okay? They would make fertility, right, in the crops, okay? So there were, the two sexual practices and worship of foreign gods and so forth often went hand in hand. Years ago, Greg Bonson did a study of the word porneia as it's found in the Septuagint, and basically showed that the capital crimes of the Old Testament, that word porneia kind of was used to classify the capital crimes. Remember, we said there was like 18 different capital crimes in the Old Testament. Okay? So what I'm going to suggest to you today is that anything that could be considered a capital crime in the Old Testament might legitimately be grounds for divorce. I say might be. And the reason is, we have to remember, murder required the death penalty. Everything else permitted the death penalty, but there was always grounds for leniency. So, a spouse might commit a capital crime. The innocent spouse who sets the punishment could be merciful, or they could call for the full penalty of the law. Okay? So what I'm going to argue that is that Old Testament capital offenses may be grounds for biblical divorce. Okay? They are allowable divorceable offenses. Not necessarily, they're not required, but they are allowable. Now what that's going to do is it's going to kind of like give us some actual objective criteria for which we might do that. Ken.
It seems like,
yeah. Because the nature of what you did was so abhorrent that that's kind of where I'm going with this. Okay, the only thing is none of us of our own right have the freedom to just count somebody off as dead. A coroner has to declare somebody dead. In this case, the elders would have to say this person's covenantally dead. I'll explain that. No, I think, there are all sorts of variables, and of course, the case of the picking up of sticks is a controversial passage. And what were they picking up sticks for? It has to do with whose fire, sacrificial fire, that is being stoked, but that gets into a lot of things. Yeah, there could be a lot of variables, and every law, I think is potentially, is subject to abuse. What I'm wanting us, I guess here I'm putting more of the focus on an innocent victim in a marriage who might today be told they don't have grounds for divorce, when in reality they do. Okay, let me put all this together. So what I'm saying is that word that Jesus uses, porneia, while it tends to focus on sexual practices, which is why it's usually translated sexual immorality, it is used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which, Jesus and the apostles quote, to refer to things broader than that. Okay? In essence, things that would have been capital crimes in the Old Testament. Now, fast forward to the New Testament. We're not living in ancient Israel. The early Christians were living under Roman rule. Okay? I want to argue that death is not only physical, but it can also be covenantal. What I mean by that is, one of the things that I think is extremely important to point out is that the Old Testament laws for divorce were given alongside a whole lot of other laws which did allow for the death penalty. So they're connected, okay? The Old Testament laws for divorce were given alongside a bunch of other laws that allowed for the death penalty. And we're going to see that they therefore relate to one another. The reason I say that is because in the Old Testament, if your spouse committed a capital crime, and maybe, if it was adultery, then you might have some say in it. But let's say they go off and they kidnap somebody. They're caught. The victim of the kidnapping could call for their execution. Now, you give me a bunch of money, and I'll let you free. Okay? They could have done that. But let's say they called for the execution of the person. Well, now, you're the innocent spouse. By law, you can remarry now, right? Okay? Well, what happens if you're in a situation, you're in a culture, where they don't execute you for kidnapping? Where they send you to jail? Well, that person hasn't committed sexual immorality, so must you remain married to this inmate? Is there a way out? We could take what might have happened in ancient Israel and apply it to today. In Romans 7, Paul makes an analogy. He talks about grounds for remarriage, and he's using it. He's doing a little metaphor here to talk about how the church is no longer married to the old covenant. Okay, they died to the law. So they're free to be married in the new covenant. Let me just read from the beginning of Romans 7. Paul says, or do you not know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the law. So he's talking to the Jews in Rome. He said that the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives. For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then, if while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from the law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. Okay? Therefore, my brethren, you also have become dead to the law through the body of Christ, that you may be married to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that we should bear fruit to God. Okay? Woman is bound to a man as long as he lives. He dies, she's free to marry another. By analogy, Paul says, you've died to the law so that you're free to be married to another. You're free to be married to Christ. Now, obviously, the Romans didn't die physically, but they did die covenantally. The Bible sees death principally, first of all, in that way. God tells Adam and Eve, the day that you eat of the forbidden fruit, that you'll die. Well, we know they didn't die physically that day, but they did die covenantally. They were cast out of God's presence in the garden. Physical death resulted later. But using Paul's analogy then, what that means is that marriage is a covenant that potentially, let me just throw this out, it potentially could be dissolved not only through physical death, but covenantal death as well. And so, just reading at the bottom of the second page, in a situation where a spouse has committed a particularly grievous sin, such that it might render the marriage covenantally dead, a surviving spouse may be free to remarry. Again, maybe. We're not saying that it has to be, that the situation has to end in divorce. It's just that it's possible. Why do I say this? Why do I say a person can be declared covenantally dead and thereby allow another person to remarry? 1 Corinthians 5, and here's why I mentioned this in passing when we preached through it last year. But in 1 Corinthians 5, we have a case of sexual immorality. We have a case of porneia in the Corinthian congregation. In particular, we have a case of incest. A man has his father's wife. Now, she may have been his stepmother. The dad may have died, whatever. We don't know the details. But Paul is abhorred at the practice and the fact that the Corinthians have done nothing about it. And so he admonishes them to excommunicate the man. Okay? And then he goes on to say, in verse 9, I'm in 1 Corinthians 5, he says, not to keep company with sexually immoral people. He doesn't mean sexually immoral people of the world, because then you'd have to go out of the world, etc. But he's talking about anyone who's called a brother. And then he wraps up the chapter in verses 12 and 13. He says, for what have I to do with judging those who are outside? Do you not judge those who are inside? But those who are outside, God judges. Therefore, note there's a quote here, put away from yourselves the evil person. It's very important to point out, Paul is quoting the Old Testament there. That phrase, so put away from yourself the evil person, is found in numerous places in Deuteronomy. I list a couple places, particularly in Deuteronomy 17. And it's always used in terms of the death penalty. You execute someone, you put that evil person away from you. I'll read Deuteronomy 17, 6 and 7. Whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. The hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of the people. So you shall put away the evil from among you. Okay? That's what Paul's saying. Verse 12, same thing. Now the man who acts presumptuously and will not heed the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God or the judge, that man shall die. So you shall put away the evil from Israel. Okay? Now, notice what Paul's doing. Paul quotes that phrase, which in the Old Testament was used in regard to capital punishment. Paul is using the phrase now to apply to excommunication. Now, some people believe that what Paul has done is he's done away with the Old Covenant capital sanction by making the equivalent excommunication. I don't necessarily believe that. I think what Paul is doing is he's adapting the law to the Corinthian situation because they live in a circumstance in which the civil magistrate is not enforcing the law of God. Which would be like, well, you know, our civil rulers don't enforce the law of God. Can the church do anything to get justice for its members in such a situation where we are not granted the sword? Now, I think that's what Paul is doing there. It's like, okay, you can't execute this guy, but you can excommunicate him. You cannot render him physically dead, but you can render him covenantally dead. And so what this would imply then is that in ancient Israel, there are a host of things a person might do that could render them dead, thereby allowing their spouse to remarry. Since the laws of the land are not enacting the laws of God, the church might apply the sanction best they can by declaring a person covenantally dead, thereby allowing the so-called surviving spouse to remarry. That makes sense? Yeah.
It makes sense, but when you read Romans 7, you're like, I'm not able to read
Well, he's definitely talking about covenantal death in Romans 7. And he's talking about being dead to the law. They didn't physically die to the law. Covenantally, they died to it. Clearly, when God tells Adam and Eve, the day you eat of it, you'll surely die, he means covenantally because they didn't physically die that day. No.
Just when I read it.
Well, put it again. Think of it this way. If in ancient Israel, a person commits a capital crime, they are executed, that spouse, the person they're married to, would be free to remarry. Okay? Now, the church finds itself in a circumstance in which the civil magistrate is not enacting the capital crimes of the Old Testament, and a person commits a capital crime. Do we say then that that spouse just must continue to be married to them no matter what? Is there a way out? Okay. I think the church can declare someone, not the person, but the church could declare someone covenantally dead, thereby allowing the person. They could put away the evil person from you. They could take that Old Testament sanction, like Paul does to the man who's incestuous, and in essence, declare that person covenantally dead. They have put that evil person away from them. Let me put down here letter B at the bottom of page 3. Also, by equating the divorceable offenses of the Bible with the capital offenses, we're able to remove the guesswork involved in trying to designate what are and are not acceptable grounds for divorce. were able to allow innocent victims the opportunity to get on with their lives, even remarry if they so desire, and resume their lives just as anyone in Old Testament Israel would have under the exact same circumstances as God intended. Okay? To make this kind of concrete, go over to page 4. I have listed here various things that were capital crimes in the Old Testament that would thereby potentially be grounds for divorce. Okay? Idolatry, blasphemy, false prophecy could all be considered divorceable offenses. Okay? Think about this. Deuteronomy 13 allows for people to believe in other gods. However, you cannot evangelize for other gods. Okay? The Bible doesn't try to get in your mind. It doesn't allow the state to punish people for what they think. That's the big problem with hate crimes. Okay? Oh, you beat him up because you hate him. We're going to punish you more. Okay? No, I just beat him up because I wanted his money. You know? Had nothing to do with the fact that he was, you know, different race or whatever. Okay, well, we're not going to punish you as badly. Well, you could believe whatever you wanted, but you could not evangelize for another god. And if you did, of course, you'd be rebuked. And if you persisted in it, then it falls into that realm of contumacy. Imagine a scenario. Let's say a couple are married and the dad becomes a Mormon. And now he wants to take the children to the Mormon church, or he converts to Islam. Must the wife remain married to him? Just no, it's settled, okay? There you go. Well, must she, and then, you know, he wants to raise the children at the mosque, okay? Teach them jihad and everything. What would happen in ancient Israel is that person would, you know, be executed if they persisted in that teaching, thereby allowing the wife to divorce her husband, okay, and free her children from those bonds. And so what I'm saying is that, let's say if we had a situation like that, somebody left the church, they become a Muslim, we might say, you know, after being rebuked, going through the process, we excommunicate the person. We might say, this person is covenantally dead. You do not have to remain married to this person. We would encourage you and help you get custody of those children so that they would not be led astray by this false religion. That's what I think you could do. That would be the covenant. That's how you would apply that Old Testament law to today.
Well, in that situation, now the wife has become a widow and the children have become orphans. And so it's left to the church to help support them, take care of them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Ken.
Everywhere, and we don't know what's going on. And then you look at the cult, even though it's distorted, it's
Yeah. There's a fellow named, I hope I'm getting his name, Walter Martin. I can't remember. There used to an old book called The Kingdom of the Cults. Did I get that? Okay, yeah. And he said that all cults represent the unpaid bills of the church. That you will find in most cults, there will be elements of truth that oftentimes are held up as a mirror to the church to show you've not done your job. I can't help but think, Greg Bonson wrote an article on this a long time ago. Peter Lighthart has as well, talking about how Islam is in many respects a mirror of Christendom, showing us areas where the church is not doing its job. And I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. Okay, they do things that we don't. Brian? Yeah, that's why I'm saying a person would have to be excommunicated. And this is not, let me say this, this is not just an unbelieving spouse who just doesn't want to go to church and doesn't believe that stuff. You want to take the kids there, go ahead. This is somebody, I'm talking about somebody, you know, who, this is, you know, as Paul would say, you know, you don't have to leave them, but I'm saying this person has been excommunicated. That doesn't mean that she has to divorce, the guy, but she could. Well, let me say this. Excommunicable is contumacy. That's the only thing for which you can be excommunicated. So I guess I want to think through that a little bit more before I say that. Because you can commit anything and not be excommunicated so long as you repent. Dan, and then...
Here's a woman in a desperate situation. We must excommunicate her husband so that we can free her from it. Or rather, we've been acting on our duties to excommunicate him, and now if she wants freedom, it's for us to give it to her.
I don't know if I'm following. Is there a question? I don't know. That's more a comment.
I was saying that we don't go, this woman needs to be free. There's a reason we need to apply the law that we've been ignoring in the past.
Yeah, exactly. Paul, okay, we're good. Well, let me mention your sexual sins, and of course you might easily imply this in regard to that word porneia, because it is used in regard to homosexuality, bestiality, rape, incest, etc. All of those things, and so might be grounds for. Our friends, the church in Louisville, used to be the head of their diaconate. This is years ago. This is probably two decades ago. A family that Elisa and I, they were one of the first families to welcome us to community. Turns out that the head of the deacons, he was a lawyer, had a wife, two precious little girls. He left his wife for another man. You know, that's, well, I guess you could say that's adultery, but it's more than that. It's homosexuality, you know. That comes under that category of porneia. It's definitely broader than adultery. Think about this one. We talked about the rebellious son and repeated rebellion to authority. That's contumacy. Here's how this might apply. Let's say, and this is kind of the weakness of the position that also allows for willful desertion without specifically detailing what entails willful desertion. Like I said, some people say that just means, you know, leaving the marriage, the person left, they've gone off, the other person is free. Others want it to include a failure to support, to provide conjugal rights, physical abuse, or whatever under willful desertion. But it always kind of leaves it sort of gray. You know, is this willful desertion? Is this not? What happens if the guy repeatedly physically abuses his wife? Well, let's say a man beats his wife very badly, puts her in the hospital. Remember, in ancient Israel, attempted murder is the same as murder. You attempted the crime, that's the same as if you were successful at it. Okay? That person can be executed, or in this case, excommunicated. But let's say that the guy, he doesn't do that, but he gets out of control, he hits his wife. Okay? He's rebuked by the elders. Don't do that anymore, you know, and he's counseled. Well, then he pushes her another time. The elders show up, hey, don't be doing this, you know. And then he does it a third time. At some point you have to say, look, you know, this is persistent rebellion to authority. This is contumacy. Okay? If the rebellious son could have been potentially executed for repeated violations and unwillingness to submit to authority, what I'm arguing is you might do the same to protect a woman from physical abuse. And say, you know, this is contumacy. You have persisted in this behavior. Or again, it might be, you know, Paul says the one who doesn't provide for his own household is worse than an infidel. A person who will not get a job, who will not do anything, support his family, something like that. I mean, and he's been, you've tried to help him. Lisa, she used to work at visually impaired preschool services, and she would go into these homes. A family would have a child born with blindness. They had no experience with it and stuff. And, you know, a lot of those were in eastern Kentucky and so forth. And there's one home she went into, the head of the family was there. He shot himself in the foot as a way to provide for his family. You know, at least he was doing something. You know, it was, instead of going out and getting a job, it's like, well, I need disability, so he shot himself in the foot, you know. In that culture, that's, well, he was providing for his family, you know. But, you know, you see what I'm saying is that this contumacy, then, this persistent rebellion to authority would be, because it was potentially an executable offense in the Old Testament, could be an excommunicable offense in the New Testament. Long story short, when Paul says says execute the guy, the incestuous guy, and he applies that verse, so you shall put the evil person away from him, that is in Deuteronomy 13 and 17, referring to execution. When he's applying that to excommunication, I think he's saying you can declare someone covenantally dead, which would thereby allow the innocent spouse to remarry. And that gets rid of the guesswork. What are divorceable offenses? Anything that might have rendered someone physically dead in the old covenant. Again, potentially, doesn't mean you have to, but it could potentially be. That takes the guesswork out of things. Last point, I will say, you don't have the right to declare somebody covenantally dead. Okay, you're not the coroner. You go before the elders. This is what my spouse is doing. The elders try to seek repentance and so forth. The person refuses to. They're excommunicated. Then the church says, you have our blessing to remarry. Paul.
Suffer for 30 years, and you don't even know when it's after 30 years.
Well, I would, before I just say blanket, yes, I'd want to know more details about the circumstance. But yeah, potentially that's the case, that a person would do something where today they would go to prison, whereas in ancient Israel, remember, there were no prisons. You might be temporarily held till you await trial, but there's no, you're either beaten or you make restitution or you're executed, and that's it. No, I do believe to say this as well. Because
but
in ancient...
Getting out of marriage,
though,
is,
do what?
But getting out of marriage is different.
Yeah, unfortunately today it's really complicated. It's more complicated in Louisiana. Boy, they make you fill out all kinds of forms and stuff. But anyway, I digress, okay? Multiple copies. They had me, I sent stuff in, they sent me back, you had to do this, and I had to get my ordination certificate out of my frame and make a copy and send it all in. Kentucky, I mean, I could get ordained in the First Church of Knee Deep in Holiness and download the certificate and no, it's serious. Because like adultery was also functional by the state, it's like joint jurisdiction. Now, unfortunately, today it's so complicated. The state and the church are not on the same page. It makes it very difficult. But I think it is potentially punishable by state and church. So it's both. You said you had two questions?
I do. I'll wait.
Yep.
This is from the Give a Life category.
Are you ready? Okay. As long as you are.
So he goes to jail for 30 years, but she knows for a fact. He says that she actually saw somebody else commit the crime.
That she did what?
She knows his citizen.
Yeah.
He's in jail for 30 years.
Okay. Yeah. Well, she, again, going back to what I said, the capital crimes, the only thing that required execution was murder. Everything else was potentially the victim got to determine the punishment up to said amount. She doesn't have to divorce the guy.
Could she? Would it be wrong to divorce if he is innocent and in jail for 30 years?
I don't know. I'd have to think about that one. That might be beyond my pay grade there. I'd have to think about that. Yeah. Did you have one more?
I really like the system that you've laid out. It really seems good. And it really is one of my concerns, just that at least I think I've been around other situations where people figured out a way to get a divorce because they want one.
Right.
And I really like the idea of going through the leadership of the elders of the church to grant that excommunication is necessary, and therefore the divorce is permissible. Are there any cases, so that's long-winded, but are there any cases where excommunication is granted or can be granted or should be carried out when there was an offense that was not punishable by death and the old covenant?
Anything, this, you know, persistent rebellion to authority could... No, well, that is punishable by death. I'm trying to... I don't know if I'm... Could you be excommunicated for something that wasn't a capital offense?
Burning the gumbo is close.
Burning the gumbo, that would be close. No, is it persistently hurt? That would be good. No, I think the wonderful thing about the case of the rebellious son is... If anything is persisted in and the person will not repent, they came to him with gluttony and drunkenness, neither of which were civil laws. There was no crime in gluttony and drunkenness, but it was that persistent rebellion and refusal to repent that made it an executable offense. And so I think that there could be things that were, because they were persistent in, they would be excommunicable.
So the purpose for excommunication is restoration.
What's one purpose?
Yeah. So if you know, this is a hypothetical situation, but if you go through crime,
Well, then she's moved on with her life. I will tell you, we in Presbytery a couple of years ago, we excommunicated a pastor in our Presbytery. He was counseling a woman. He ended up in an affair with her. He left his wife. We excommunicated him. He, about a year ago, came back before the Presbytery. He broke off the relationship with her. He's repented back in church. His wife was willing to take him back. And she hadn't, but was willing to work towards doing that. So again, you're not required. But Lisa made it real quick. You're missing that. Just don't even think about it. But his wife, in fact, he moved in with her. He had no place to stay. And the Lord, he was delivered over Satan. Now, we made it real clear, you cannot have conjugal relations because you're not married anymore. But he had a room that he was renting out.
They have legally divorced?
They did, yes.
I don't think you could back and marry the same person that you divorced.
No, you can, not if they have married another. Then you never can. Okay? And what you see there, God divorced Israel in the Babylonian captivity. But in Jeremiah 3:8, but the return of captivity was a remarriage. Now, once God married, Christ marries the bride of the church, AD 70, there's no going back to Israel. Okay?
Why does the church recognize the civil magistrate of marriage?
Do what?
Yeah. Why does the church recognize the civil magistrate?
Because there were civil sanctions attached to a violation of the marriage covenant. That's why historically, because adultery wasn't just punishable by the church, it was punishable by the state as well. In there's no fault divorce in the Bible. The innocent spouse gets everything. It's not like a division of half and half. The innocent spouse gets everything. And the state may have to enforce that. Now, there has been talk today about pastors or churches that, you know, forget civil ceremonies because of the gay marriage thing, and let's just do, but then what happens if some, you know, what do you do going for the law if there's some problem? It's horrible, the circumstances now with the, you know, just not working out, the state grants no fault divorce and everything. It's terrible. Okay. We're over time, so. Think about it. I think there's a beauty in this. I think we see graciousness in God's law, and we actually kind of take away the guesswork. So something to think about. You're dismissed.